And then you say, well, the real answer is, question is, how do you get to socialism? And you give one answer, and then you fail to say something else. You say, workers learn fighting over the crumbs. Well, look, you know, I've got to put it to you this way. If by fighting over the crumbs, workers really learn that the real struggle is not for the crumbs, but for the bakery, then I have to put it to you this way. Workers have been fighting for the crumbs for a bloody long time. Workers have been fighting for the crumbs not just since the 1880s, but a long time longer than that. The class struggle has been going on for a long time, and I'm afraid this idea that somehow, out of this fight over the crumbs, without actually talking about socialism, without actually putting forward clear ideas, because you're not allowed to do that, because somehow this is frowned upon as being, you know, I mean, it's caricatured in a rather ludicrous way that we sit around in rooms having nice ideas and socialism drops out of the sun and Christ knows what. No one's arguing that. What we're arguing, very simply, is that you don't actually change ideas except by putting ideas. Now, if you actually engage, for example, and incidentally, let me correct one thing, for Christ's sake, don't go in for this absurdly sectarian and laughable sort of game of point scoring about which party knocked off more policemen's hats during the miners' strike. I mean, don't be silly. Somebody like myself, I was involved in the miners' strike. I am a trade unionist. I don't know which trade union you're a member of. I don't know which trade union he's a member of, and I'm not doubting your credentials as trade unionists. I'm a secretary of a trade union. I'm an active trade unionist. I was active as a trade unionist and doing my bit in supporting other trade unionists in strike. Not just the miners in Britain, but the miners in a very important strike in South Africa, where miners weren't just beaten up on the picket line, but were murdered on the picket line by police with guns. The miners in Poland, who are still incarcerated in prisons for daring to stand up against the state. So don't engage in this kind of infantile point scoring about nobody in one particular colliery wants to read the Socialist Standard, as if you've done a survey of everyone there to know it. But let me put this point to you. The fact of the matter is, when you join the Socialist Party, you join a party which has got a set of principles. When you join the Socialist Workers' Party, you join a party that's got clearly stated arguments, a political position, and you either agree with it and join, or you disagree with it, and you don't. Or maybe in the course of being a member, you've come to disagree with it, and then you leave. Now, you are a member of a Leninist organisation. That's all very well. My opponent's saying, well, you know, William Morris is the wallpaper designer. William Morris was a revolutionary socialist. He might as well say, you know, well, Lenin, he was just some bloke in Russia living in the beginning of this century. The fact of the matter is, Lenin and Leninism is a political theory that you either accept or you reject. And the theory of Leninism is a very clear one. It is based upon the assumption that the workers have to be led to socialism. Now, you either accept that and you are a Leninist, or you chuck it out and you're not. And if you're a member of a Leninist organisation, the answer to the question, how do we get socialism, is the answer that Lenin gave and that I quoted. And although he accused me of distortion, he's given me no evidence for it whatsoever, because it's a direct quotation, and there are many of them. What Lenin argued, and it's a perfectly plausible theory, just happens to be one that is historically contemptuous towards the working class, and it's also, I would say, one which is wrong, which is that you have to have a leadership, because you can't wait for workers to understand socialism, you can't put socialist ideas to workers. What you have to do is lead workers into socialism, pretty well without them knowing for it. They're still fighting for the crumbs, and you win the bakery for them without them knowing it. And I put this question very simply, arising out of what you say, and perhaps my opponent will answer it. You say, look, the miners' strike is a good example. You say, after the miners' strike, some of the finest socialists were made as a result of that strike. You say, hundreds of copies of a book are being demanded by miners who want to read it. Well, let me put the question to you. In practical terms, how many more socialists are there now in Britain in 1985 than there were in Britain before the miners' strike started? How many active socialists are there? The fact of the matter, as you know and any other active member of the Socialist Workers' Party knows, is as a result of the defeat of the miners' strike, your own membership is falling. As a result of the defeat of the miners' strike, socialist worker sales are falling. If you read the article by Paul Foote in the current issue of Socialist Worker, he tells you that whereas he was addressing a rally of 2,000 people in Newcastle this time last year, this year there was a mood of despondency. Most of the people there were dispirited and lacking in enthusiasm. The fact of the matter is, what the miners' strike has done is by producing a sense of hope in workers for a victory within the wages system, it has, sadly, it's a historical tragedy. It has created a mood of despair and political cynicism among thousands and thousands of miners. And that is something, that is a reality we have to face today. That all over the country and all over the world, there are workers who we have to deal with on the basis of the fact that they're not socialists. On the basis of the fact that they do feel weak. They do feel that trade unions aren't going to get them enough. They do feel that the so-called reform and left parties aren't going to get them anywhere. And what we have to do is present them with an alternative. For the Socialist Workers' Party to come along and say the alternative is to repeat the same mistakes of 1887, the same mistakes of 1984, to advocate that no pit closures is an achievable aim within capitalism, it's simply going to lead to greater disillusion. That might be a hard message for you to swallow, but it's one which, when the history of the 1980s is looked at, and if you're a socialist, you should be looking at it while it's happening, not after the event, you'll see. That's the period we're living through.
You call the first name.
Yeah, there was a question asked about how many miners are there now. Socialists after the strike that was started and eventually failed, the fact remains that there are miners today who are far more politically aware and certainly aware as regards socialism and towards the need for an organised working class. Especially among where there was the tighter, smaller communities where the women were involved, there are miners' wives today who are politically aware and interested in socialist issues, where a few years ago they would be the women that in the traditional model just telling their husbands to go back to work. So, I mean, a lot has come out of that, this minor strike, no doubt about it. I mean, that can't be denied. I can't sit there and say exactly how many there were, you know, whether it's 50 or 30 or whatever, I don't know. But, I mean, we do know that there are more people interested in politics generally, which is going to be a good advance from working class people who normally would not be interested. Right? And any advance in that direction of working class consciousness cannot be dismissed at all. And not only that, amongst the various people the various workers up and down the country that were supported that strike in one way or another, they suddenly found themselves visiting other factories other than their own, other workers coming together and talking about the issues. I mean, you can't just brush that aside. And if you want to talk about the other part you mentioned about, working class generally, about, you know, those falling numbers in lectures, a reduced number of workers interested in socialism and everything. I mean, that is part of the background of the general downturn in workers' participation before the miners' strike, and of course it's resumed after the miners' strike. I mean, there was a whole backdrop of downturn in working class struggle. The miners' strike just come right in the middle of it.
Okay, contributions. Question.
I'd like to first draw people's attention to the analogy of the Socialist Workers' Party. You talk about smashing the system, and I think most people agree that to smash something is an act of violence, which brings me on to your strategy, where you seem to think that by not engaging in what you call abstract propaganda, but merely stimulating workers into some form of action through industrial crises and so on, then you will arrive at some kind of smashing the system. Well, I think most people here realise that there was an industrial crisis in Germany in the 20s and 30s, and that workers were stimulated into taking action. And there wasn't much abstract propaganda around, as you call it. In other words, there was no clear socialist message. Workers then took up fascism. And I think what you are preaching will lead to fascism.
Just the German analogy. I mean, how many workers... Okay, I agree there was a switch in vote, but you've got to ask yourself, you know, what are the reasons? Why did a number of ex-socialists vote for Hitler? Why did some ex-members of the German Communist Party vote for Hitler? Why did Hitler come to power in 1933? You're talking about abstract propagandism. I mean, one would have to look at the whole role of Stalinism and the control over the German Communist Party from Moscow. The whole argument, ludicrous argument, that Trotsky argued very much against, when the German Communist Party were told, instead of forming a united front with the German socialists, they were told to condemn the German socialists as social fascists. And Hitler rode that whole bloody thing, agreed on a working class vote. But this is a point that Steve brought up. I mean, absolutely ludicrous. We recognise, ever since Disraeli's time, ever since the formation of the modern Conservative Party in the 1880s, 3 million British workers, the Afghanets of every generation, have voted for the Tory Party. We recognise these sort of problems. We recognise probably the vast majority of British workers also are racists. But our argument is that people only change their reactionary ideas in struggle by getting involved, or involved in things, say, like the Anti-Nazi League. Movements, what we call consciousness raising. You know, okay, you're coming back to, you're arguing we're leading to a fascist society. You brought in the element...
The point you've indulged in what you call abstract propaganda, you're not raising consciousness, you're really encouraging people to smash the system.
Yeah.
Is that
revolution? Our, yes.
What does smashing...
Just come on the first point. Our argument is that you don't make a revolution through sitting on your bloody arse and reading books.
Who says it is?
Well, that's the sort of argument that you're putting forward. You know, you haven't related. Okay, you've agreed you're a trade unionist.
You mustn't caricature your argument, sir. Come on, let's have a serious debate.
I've never seen you at a miners' support. I've never seen any of the members of the Guildford Socialist Party of Great Britain at a local miners' support meeting. In the labour rooms, where we raised £7,000, regularly ran coaches and trips down to the mining valleys, put up miners. Yes, you're saying this is irrelevant. Just coming back.
Can we take another question?
Well, the element of force and violence, I mean, I haven't dealt with, but I think it's incredibly important.
Can you sum it up?
Yes, okay.
Violence. And we've talked tonight, we've heard you both condemn wars because they're against capitalism and they're aggressive. Now, I want to know, when you get to your utopia of socialism, your way or your way, how are you going to handle aggression?
What sort of aggression? Personal aggression?
It's a very aggressive meeting.
The old man coming along on a Friday night and beating up the missus.
All right, I'll put it from
okay,
a female point of view.
Okay, I think that's also rooted in the capitalist system.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the aggression that you're going to have to charge up in people to achieve what you want. How are you going to say to people, now we're going to live in peace? Because you're raising aggression, and what are you going to do when you get there with that aggression?
A couple of brief
answers. Constant aggression. As we said earlier, you know, a lot of violence and aggression, social violence, is rooted in the capitalist system. I can't really give you a sort of clear answer. Things could go wrong. No, sorry.
You know, Steve's put us forward as if we're frozen. You put us in a little frozen compartment. You know, when he was quoting bloody Lenin as if it's the Bible and talking about the 1880s and William Morris. You know, we recognise that ideas change, that a lot of Marx's ideas have got to be applied to the 1980s. Marx was writing before the invention of bloody telephones, before automation, before electricity, before the rise of multinational corporations. No, no, it relates to what you're saying. I'm not gazing into a crystal ball. Things could go wrong.
Okay.
But if wars and aggression and so on and violence are rooted in the capitalist system, putting it very simply, I think there is a lot of other personal violence, family violence, and aggression between men and women, between parents and children. You know, if you're going to look at real life situations. Yes, I'm not going to say, oh yes, everything, after the revolution, everything's going to be rosy. You use the word utopian. Everything's going to change.
Okay.
We hope it will. We don't know.
Well, I think it's actually a tremendously important question, in fact, because if socialism means anything, it's going to mean a change in the way people live, a change in lifestyles, and it's going to affect people. I don't like these ideas of socialism where the factories change and the minds change, but the people don't change. I think if socialism isn't going to be a different society to live in, then I'm not going to be working for socialism. And it's because it will be a different society to live in. And it's because it will be a society that I want to live in, as opposed to the kind of society we are living in, that I'm a socialist. That's quite simple. And I'll answer the point by making two statements. First of all, I'm in favour. Hope it's not going to upset you too much, but I'm in favour of political aggression. Tell you why I'm in favour of political aggression. It's when you don't have political aggression, what you have are political sedatives. And when you have political sedatives, you end up with the Labour Party and the SDP and the Tory Party. I'm in favour of people being bold about their points of view. I'm in favour of people standing up and saying, I disagree with what you're saying. This is why I disagree. I'm in favour of people being energetic and vigorous about their politics, because we're not going to get socialism by people sitting around reading books. And I think that one of the things I'm most opposed to is the kind of nonsense we've had in this debate, where people aren't actually dealing with points. What we're getting are caricatures. I think what we want to actually deal with are the points that are being raised. I think I could answer your point about aggression by saying this. I regard myself as a scientific socialist. In other words, I look at causes. And I ask, what is the cause of aggression? And I say, the cause of aggression are the kind of relationships we have in society today. And I ask, what kind of relationships are they? And I say, above all, they're possessive relationships. They're relationships based upon property. They're based upon, that's my child, that's my wife, that's my woman, my man, my country, my race, my God. And people are taught to think in terms of this kind of absurd possession, when in fact, cooperation means people working together. It means recognising that the benefit of everyone is in fact the benefit of the individual. That no person, I would argue, and this isn't a moral statement, it's a materialist statement, no person can go to bed tonight and say there are people dying in a world with food mountains because they're starving to death. That there are people who are dying of hypothermia, while at the same time we're closing down coal mines and cutting down electricity production. No one can do that without recognising those contradictions. And of course they make us angry, and that's why socialism is at least in part the politics of anger and indignation against a system that is oppressing us and pushing us down and presenting us with insecurity. And it's that insecurity that creates aggressive people. It's that insecurity that creates the people who are members of the working class who go and join the police force. It's that insecurity that creates the people who go and join the army. It's that insecurity that creates the parents who beat up their kids. It's that insecurity that creates the nurses in overcrowded hospitals who've been known to beat up geriatric patients of 80 or 90. Psychiatric patients. That's what capitalism is doing. That is the aggression. And as a scientific thinker, I say, when you eliminate a cause, you get rid of the symptoms. And when you get rid of a society of competition and establish a society of cooperation, a society of common ownership, where what belongs to me belongs to everyone else, where the world that I live in is inhabited by everyone else and owned and controlled by everyone else in common, we get rid of the need for aggression. We get rid of the need not only for wars on a mass scale, but the war that we're all involved in every day of the week to try and keep our job, families, pay the rent, pay off the mortgage. That is the insecurity of capitalism that breeds aggression. I agree with my opponent. Socialism isn't going to overnight transform us all into people who are going to walk around with happy, smiling faces, because I'll never have a bloody happy, smiling face all the day, whatever sort of society we live in. And incidentally, I think it would be a pretty boring society if everyone did walk around with happy, smiling faces, because the pubs are going to have to be shut at least 1 hour a week during a year in socialism, so a few of us are going to be miserable. But of course, there's going to have to be the elimination of the cause. Get rid of competition and establish cooperation. But I cannot emphasise enough that that is precisely the kind of politics that is dismissed as being abstract. I would argue that it's precisely the kind of politics that grabs the imaginations of workers. If we can go to workers and say, imagine a society where you don't have to think about money anymore because you've got free access to the goods and services of the world. Imagine a society where you never need to have another fear about a nuclear holocaust or a conventional one. Imagine a society where the threat of the dole queue is no longer there, where the monotony of wage slavery is no longer there, where the hateful relationships based upon money and wages and employers and employees are no longer there. I think that can grab more people into the socialist movement over the next year than 100 minor strikes which end in defeat. That's what I think, and I think we can show it. We can show it by the fact that the socialist movement is recruited from people who understand, not simply that they want to fight to keep pits open, because I notice a lot of the people who are fighting to keep pits open aren't too anxious to go down the dirty, stinking pits where people have to waste their lives away. I notice a lot of the people who are fighting for conventional weapons and instead of nuclear weapons aren't too keen to have to go out into wars like the Falklands, which was one of these humane conventional wars. I would say that is a society and that is a proposition to put to workers that could grab hundreds of thousands of people into the socialist movement. And that is why we urge people to help us to do precisely that.
Well, there's a couple more questions lining up.
That what we've seen before us tonight, I think, is very, very important. You know, because I think what we've witnessed here tonight is a head-on collision between rhetoric on the one hand and analysis on the other hand. And I'd like to make one or two observations, if I may, illustrating this contrast. Now, the Socialist Workers' Party speaker said some time ago that the struggles, the fragmentary, incomplete, unsatisfactory struggles of workers in their day-to-day occupations must be our starting point, and he threw this at the other speaker. Well, I thought that was a bit unfair, because, you know, I thought that the first speaker, Steve Coleman, had indeed taken those struggles as his starting point. He may not have taken them as his finishing point, but he certainly took them as his starting point. Now, if you both take these struggles as your starting point, which I think you both do, the question then becomes, having started with this raw material of struggle, messy, fragmentary, incomplete struggle, what are you going to do with it? And you had this during a minor strike. Now, I looked at the different responses of the two parties involved in that strike. During the minor strike, you had the SPGB dishing out leaflets saying, perhaps incredibly to miners, abolish the wages system, get rid of capitalism. That's what I call analysis, because it was backed up by all of these arguments about capitalism can't do this and can't do that, and socialism could do this and could do that. Now, from the Socialist Workers' Party, you had leaflets which, may I say, were a bit more shallow. They simply said, win the strike, victory to the miners, keep the pits open. I am tempted to say that is rhetoric, and it's no substitute for analysis, even though it's very popular in a sense, because it's got a lot of emotion, vitality, perhaps even virility. Now, on a more personal note, secondly, the Socialist Workers' Party referred several times to the Anti-Nazi League, and he said, that's the kind of thing. You set up, you initiate the Anti-Nazi League, and you win over these anti-racists. Well, my first political involvement some years ago was with the Anti-Nazi League. And I can tell you for a start that I got involved with that because I was an anti-racist. It didn't teach me a thing. I was an anti-racist. I wasn't sure what to do about it. So somebody comes along and says, oh, we're the anti-racist group. You have to join in our demonstration or march or gig, whatever it was. I didn't learn much from it. In fact, quite the opposite. Because when I went down to Victoria Park, where they had the Rock Against Racism gig in 77,
Well, I found a socialist worker being sold on the street in East London on the way to Victoria Park, which I'd never seen before, and quite frankly, it left me bewildered and confused and despondent and disillusioned and not quite sure what I was doing, because I thought I was just an anti-racist. Now there's all of this talk about the industrial struggle, which wasn't very clear and didn't really teach me very much about socialism. So in fact, I had to sort of extricate myself from that and return to square one as a straightforward, simple anti-racist. So what I'm saying there is that the Trotskyist involvement in these campaigns does more harm than good. It actually takes people who are quite sincere, if naive, in their anti-racism, and screws them up and fills them with all kinds of old-fashioned Leninist dogmas about the vanguard revolutionary party, which I quickly got away from. Now, that's so much of a strategy. If the chairman will bear with me for a moment or two longer, let me move on quickly to the question of your aim. I think it would be unfair for the Socialist Party of Great Britain to accuse the SWP of not having said what their aim is. What the SWP have said their aim is with socialism is workers' councils, workers' control. Now, having made that concession, I must immediately say it's not a very precise definition, because if you've still got workers, you've still got that identity of being a worker, I'd argue that that implies you've perhaps got others who aren't workers. In other words, you've still got this lingering label, but there are those who are workers in society, and they are the ones who are in control. And indeed, the Socialist Workers' Party speaker said at one point, and I quote him because I've scribbled it down, if the ruling class had been defeated in the miners' strike, then that would have given more chance to other groups of workers in their struggles. Well, surely if the ruling class had been defeated, that would be it. There'd be more of those struggles. So you've got this kind of dual picture where you've got sort of semi-defeats and semi-victories the whole time. I think in contrast to that, you have the Socialist Party saying, well, look, what the aim must be is not for workers to improve their condition, but in fact, to get rid of their status as workers. The label itself is what's got to be abolished. Now, third and finally, having commented on strategy and on the aim, I'd like to comment on what I see as some of the most offensive point. You've obviously by now guessed where my allegiances tend to lay, but I'll say what I think is the most offensive point about Leninism as represented by the SWP, and that is the leadership aspect. This is my final point, because you see, the SWP speaker said towards the end of his speech, the party must provide leadership. And he said that you're riding on the crest of the wave, and then, having done that, you must then start to get really stuck in and control and direct the movement. Well, I defy you to control my movements, if you'll excuse the expression. Because, quite frankly, Harry, who is he to say whether I'm going to be one of the leaders or one of the followers in this process? I defy to be classified in that way. And I'm much more attracted, as I think a lot of people are, towards the alternative, what I would call the genuinely socialist conception. You have no leadership, you don't have a vanguard of professionals, which is what this lot set themselves up to be. Instead, you have a much more equal, equality-based system of analysis, not rhetoric.
Yeah, I mean, you made so many bloody points. Some have come up in the summary. I mean, the last one, it seems to me, you see, that revolution is an incredibly authoritarian business. You know, to smash a modern industrial society, looking at the sort of weapons that the army and the police have got, is an incredibly difficult business. And just keep shouting about, how are you going to do it? What is the strategy? Where is the party? Where is the coordination? Quite honestly, I think you want incredible discipline. No ruling class ever withdraws voluntarily from the stage of history. It's a tremendous struggle, a tremendous fight back. You know, how the hell are you going to do it with just words and rhetoric, no organisation, no party, no coordination, no leadership? You may well be right. I am not saying... Huh?
I didn't say no party or no coordination. I said okay. No leadership.
Okay, well, how do you bring coordination about of all the local struggles? How did they make it? Okay, I know you people have written off the Russian Revolution, but how did they make it in October 1917? A revolution.